Welcome to another edition of The Spirit Revolution. My name is Philip Coppens.
My name is Kathleen McGowan.
We continue our discussion and our celebration of Kathleen's launch of The Poet Prince. Because last week, we actually ran out of time. There is so much to discuss about the Renaissance. Go figure, there is so much to talk about a spirit revolution.
Go on, yes.
In fact, where we left it off, and just to kind of like as a recap for those people who've been still unable or who might have forgotten certain of the things we were discussing about last week, The Poet Prince is about Lorenzo de' Medici. It's about his central role into transforming Italy into from a pretty much a very normal country into something more. And he does this by creating a genuine spirit revolution, the Renaissance, the very rebirth of old principles. And as we were saying last time around, it isn't just about this connection to Plato, but it's also about going to go back to the roots of original Christianity, of the traditions which made Christianity so powerful at its beginning, and which pretty much today perplexes people, because whenever I hear people say, like, well, it's really strange how Christianity became such a popular cult. And it is obviously because Christianity, as we know it today, has got very little to do with Christianity the way it was back then. We have forgotten this thing. But specifically, the very first emphasis as a culture, rather than as an individual person or a little group of people, as a culture, the very first reacquaintance with what original Christianity was about and putting back into practice what was there, happened in Florence, happened under the tuition, under the help, the guiding hand of the Medici family, and from there it went across Europe, and it was a genuine revolution, a very solid revolution, which at some point actually threatened the church. We might actually come back to that at some point, as to what the church has to do as a reaction about a century onwards, with the likes of Giordani Bruno and various other aspects involved. But where we left it off last week was with Lorenzo himself. Lorenzo, the man who had more charisma than 10 Obamas together, a man who was able to do so many things for Florence. And it's not so much as a spoiler, but there is this wonderful aspect of Lorenzo as to how he gets excommunicated. It is the most interesting thing about history and typifies what he was trying to do and how upset the Catholic Church was with his leader.
Well, not only does Lorenzo end up getting excommunicated, but the entire Republic of Florence is excommunicated for supporting him. And this is one of the great sort of moments in Florentine history, I think, is, and this goes back to, you know, we were talking last week, and I want to bring this theme in at the beginning of this show. We were talking about the fact that the Medici family has been demonized by history over and over again, when in fact they were extraordinary humanists, incredibly philanthropic, terribly charitable, you know, and, you know, it frustrates me so much. I read something about Cosimo de' Medici and it will say, well, of course, he only gave to the poor and he only rebuilt the monasteries and he only did, you know, all of these incredible community service, you know, events because he wanted to improve his reputation or because he wanted people to like him. You know, it's so unfair when someone who was as charitable as Cosimo de' Medici and later Lorenzo, you know, is tarred with this brush. They only did it because it made them look good. And this is all sort of the things that happen later to try to demonize them when they become the absolute, you know, antithesis of what is happening in Rome and therefore become the enemies of the church. But the fact is, first of all, the Medicis are the first real liberals. They are the first essential liberal family. What happens is Cosimo is such a progressive force in terms of his society, not just in terms of art and politics, but the way that he views the world. His worldview is one of absolute humanism. Live and let live. Let's be peaceful with each other. Let's take care of each other. And he he puts his money where his mouth is over and over again. He puts so much money into the communities. And the other thing that he does that I think is extraordinary is that he speaks out. He is the first person in his time to speak out and take a very powerful stand on the issue of gay rights. And it was so interesting for me because when I was writing The Poet Prince during a time in California when we were going through this horrible period of something called Proposition 8. And Proposition 8 was this piece of hate legislation that I'm to this moment embarrassed ever passed in the state of California. And basically it was a piece of legislation to deny gay couples the right to be married. And there was a very, very bitter battle in California over this proposition, and there was an awful lot of hate spewed by those people who supported the ban on gay marriage, a lot of prejudice, a lot of anger. It was truly a terrible time. As a Californian, I was so disgusted by it. I firmly believe that love is love and is not to be judged by anybody. And if two people love each other, they should have the right to do whatever they want to do to celebrate that union. And I don't believe anyone has the right to stop that. And I also will never understand how someone who is marrying someone they love threatens anybody else's marriage. It just doesn't make any sense to me. But what was powerful for me during that time is I'm writing during this period of Proposition 8, I'm writing about the Medici family, and I'm writing about Cosimo de' Medici, you know, in the middle of the 1400s, he is standing up and saying, you people need to get a life and leave the artists alone. Because what was happening was, it started with Donatello. Donatello was accused of outrageous behavior. Donatello's extraordinary sculpture of David. Because remember, before Michelangelo, we have Donatello. And Donatello is the one who really inspires the Renaissance sculpture movement. And Donatello is the first sculptor since the ancient Greeks to sculpt a complete male nude figure in the round. And if you have never seen Donatello's David, I highly recommend that you look for it online. It is incredibly beautiful. But his David is very... he's a very beautiful, very naked, younger man. And it caused all kinds of controversy when he created it. And a lot of Florentines, now for the most part, Florentines were educated, advanced, cultured, artistic, but there were still some who were conservative and sort of, you know, heavily cowed by the church. And those who came out against it said it was obscene. It was obscene that Donatello was creating this kind of art. And it was even more obscene that he was homosexual and therefore using, you know, his boyfriends as his models. And it's Cosimo de' Medici who goes into the council in Florence and takes a stand and says, what is wrong with you people? How dare you judge who this man loves? And by the way, if he can create art this magnificent, this unprecedented in our lifetimes or in any lifetime for the last 1400 years, then who are you or who is anyone to judge what inspires him? You know, and this was the magnificence of Cosimo de' Medici's leadership. I tell this story in The Poet Prince, and I show you that Lorenzo is with Cosimo when he makes one of these statements in Florence, you know, at a council meeting, defending the rights of his artists to live and to love in any way they so choose and in peace. And I truly believe that Lorenzo was so inspired and so impressed by his grandfather at a very young age that he takes all of these concepts of humanism and equality and love. This is the piece that people don't understand about the Medici. There was so much love in this family for each other, for their artists, for their friends, and for their community. These people truly believed in love and in its power. And Lorenzo ruled Florence with love. And this is why the people called him, from the time he was 10 years old, Lorenzo was called their prince. The people of Florence would have done anything for Lorenzo from the time he was born till the time he died.
And he steps in as we were saying, his conception, everything about his birth was magical in the very literal sense of that word. But he is also the Horus of Florence. He is the guy who sits on this magnificent chair and rules Florence as a benign leader. And it's very much the concept of ancient Egypt with the role of Horus, whereby every pharaoh sat on the throne of Egypt in emulation of Horus. So you have this extraordinary layer. Now, as a tiny bit of digression maybe, but just to illustrate another aspect, which I always found extremely interesting, is that Cosimo, at one point, together with Pope John the 22nd, they were in Florence together, and we don't really know why exactly, but they seem to have had, with all the knowledge they became exposed to, an early exposure to the theory of evolution, because they felt that they had to do a scientific experiment, and for this, they brought together certain amounts of animals. I've forgotten which animals precisely, but there was definitely a giraffe, and there was definitely a lion there. And the standard theory was that when all of these animals were introduced in a very confined space, they would all start to fight to death, survival of the fittest. And what they did was, in the presence of Pope John the 22nd, who was, by the way, a very good friend of Cosimo, they began to watch what was going to happen when these animals were introduced into one cage together. And guess what? Nothing happened. They all lived very happily next to each other. I think the lion went to sleep and the giraffe just kept chewing the leaves he was eating. And it showed to them something about, you know, like how the survival of the fittest and this very violent nature, which is typical pretty much of civilization, society, Western society up to that era, with all the wars, that this really is not the only way to go, that there is also a peaceful way, and Lorenzo definitely typifies this. And also, as liberal as they were, as open-minded as they were about the issues of gay rights and all of these other topics, they were also liberal in the sense that they were setting themselves in such opposition to Christian fundamentalism. And in your book, you open with an extremely powerful scene, which I will let you talk about.
Oh, yes. We will talk about that. You know, one of the things, there is a sub-theme to this book, and that theme is about the difference between compassion and fanaticism, and where Christianity goes astray, and how from the first century on, there were essentially two specific factions and teachings of Christianity, which each sort of grew and evolved into their own way. And the ancients referred to them as the compassionates and the fanatics. And so I opened the book with a scene that illustrates that. And the scene is the story of Saint Felicity. The story of Saint Felicity is one that I discovered kind of by accident, although, of course, nothing is an accident on this trail. As I was scouring the many art museums and churches in Florence, I think this was probably my fourth or fifth trip in researching the poet Prince. And for those who have never been to Florence, I cannot recommend it highly enough if you are an art fan, because it's just, it's heaven. It's absolutely Mecca for art lovers, because the churches in Florence are every bit as magnificent and important as the museums. Some of the greatest art in the world is actually contained in the churches, and it's free, by the way, to go and visit. So Florence is the best deal in the world. You can get into the Uffizi for about the equivalent of $15, and most of the churches are free. So really, once you get there, it is the greatest bargain in the history of travel. But I was at a specific church, a church that is dedicated to a saint called Felicity, who I didn't know very much about. But I had come across it as an important church for art. I actually went there to see a Pontormo fresco. That was the only reason I went. I wanted to see this particular Pontormo fresco because I had been told that the Magdalene in it is dressed in pink and is extraordinarily beautiful. And I wanted to see her, and I did, and she is. all of those things. But that's not where I stopped at the church of Santa Felicita. What happened as I walked through this church is I discovered on one wall an enormous painting of the saint for whom this church is named, Saint Felicity. And the painting was so disturbing that I actually had to sit down in its presence. It made me so sick that I couldn't even stand up while looking at it. What I saw in this painting was this painting of this woman who is Saint Felicity in the center, and she is sort of raging. She's in this sort of insane Medea kind of look. And across her body is across her lap is the body of a young boy, probably 6 or 7 years old, a beautiful blonde child who is clearly dead. And littered about her feet are 6 other bodies of boys of different ages, all having been butchered. And it was so disturbing that it took me a while to start doing the research. But what I discovered is that Saint Felicity and her sons were all, quote, martyred. But what happens is this. Felicity was originally, in the second century, this all happens in AD 161. In the second century, she is married to a Roman nobleman, and they have 7 sons. And these people are Roman nobles. They are pagans. And then Felicity's husband dies, and she is a grieving widow with 7 children. Now, by all accounts, she was completely devoted and in love with her husband and went a little bit crazy at his death. She is then consoled in her grief by Christians. Now, what a lot of people don't understand is that there are various periods in the first 2 centuries where Christians were tolerated in Rome. They weren't necessarily welcome or loved, but, you know, some of the emperors were actually quite tolerant of Christianity because some of the early Christians were actually incredibly helpful people to have in your communities. They were building hospitals. You know, they were doing really important things in Rome. And so as long as they weren't sort of getting in the way or preaching too hard or angering the local pagan priests, they, you know, were kind of left alone, certainly under the reign of this particular emperor at the time, Antoninus Pius. He was very, he was a philosopher, and he was actually quite fascinated by the early Christians. He didn't get them necessarily, but he was really interested in them. And also, what had happened at this stage in Roman history is a lot of noble women were becoming interested in Christianity. Noble women were becoming interested in it because our early Christianity had female leaders, and there were women who were, you know, doing a lot of the work. And so this was something that a lot of the noble women in Rome were kind of finding interesting. And then what we also find is we start having, you know, the Christians are starting to intermarry with the Romans. So at this period in history, this is what's happening. And the Christians come to Felicity to administer to her in her grief. And she becomes a convert. She converts to Christianity, and she converts her children to Christianity. And one of the things that she attaches to is this idea of the afterlife. And this is one of the great schisms in Christianity because, of course, the Gnostics, the heretics, the people like us who believe that, you know, we are here to learn how to be fully human in this body and experience this life in this body on earth to its fullness. We represent one side of those traditions. But then what happens is we have another tradition, don't we, that's all about the afterlife. That what happens here in this body doesn't matter. The only thing that happens is what you do that gets you into heaven. The only thing that matters is the afterlife. And what happens is Felicity is converted by these early, more fanatical Christians who are committed to this idea that this life doesn't matter and only the afterlife matters. And they come to her and they say, look, none of this matters because you are going to, if you remain committed to God and to Jesus the way we tell you to be committed to him, you will be reunited with your husband and your children will be reunited with your husband. And you'll all be together in heaven and live happily ever after with God. So that's what you need to stay focused on. And Felicity snaps, basically, and in her sort of madness, decides that this is the way that she wants to go. Now, the problem that Christians have in this piece of history is there is a terrible plague that happens in Rome. There's a terrible influenza that sweeps through and begins to start killing people off, particularly children. And this happens in Felicity's community. And what happens is the local pagan priests decide that it's her fault, because she is now preaching Christianity in a very vocal way, and she's preaching against the pagans. So what happens is the pagans stand up, they go to the emperor, and they say, look, this plague is happening because this woman is allowed to preach her, you know, anti-pagan rhetoric, and she has made the gods angry, and the gods are punishing us for not taking a stand. So what happens is Felicity is arrested, and she is brought in before a magistrate, and the magistrate says, look, you and your boys need to stop, you know, preaching against against our traditions, otherwise we're going to have a problem. And Felicity, instead of, you know, taking her punishment, which is very mild, her punishment and the punishment for her boys is to spend 7 days in the temple making apologies, basically, to the pagan gods. And of course, she stands up and screams, I will never do that. I will never forsake the one true God. I will never forsake Jesus, and neither will my children. And all seven children come forward and say, they will not do this. Well, this escalates into an enormous crisis for Rome, because now they have to take a stand against this woman and her children who are angering the gods, but also disrespecting the Roman authority. And so the quick version of a very long and brutal story is that Felicity convinces her children, from the oldest who's in his 20s to the youngest who is 6, that it is better to die in whatever horrible, torturous way that Rome threatens you with, so that we can all be together in heaven, than it is to live. And she not only sends her children to their deaths, but she sends them to horrific, torturous deaths, cheering them on while they are being killed, so that they will not lose their faith and that they will go and die for God. And this, for me, this story made me physically ill, because it illustrated for me exactly the moment when everything goes wrong in Christianity, when we completely lost the plot. Because I do not believe for one moment that God or Jesus or any divine light being would ever, ever want us to sacrifice our children to prove our faith. And everything about it is so demented to me. And what happens is, in history, she is celebrated in Catholic tradition as one of the all-time great saints. So there is a very powerful opening scene where I show you this, and I also show you the compassionate Christians pleading with her not to do this, not to sacrifice her children. This is not what Jesus teaches. This is not what Jesus would want from you if he was here. And so I think it's a very powerful opening that shows you the difference between how we have one branch of Christianity that was all about love and compassion, and another one that became very much about this scary, fanatical dogma. And in the 21st century, you know, back to what I was talking about earlier, we have all these contrasts, you know, whether it's, you know, Felicity in the second century, who is a lot like some of the fanatics that we're hearing, you know, in other aspects of our history in the 21st century. You know, the comparisons are great and are scary. Same thing with Cosimo de' Medici. It is scary to me and sad that a man in the 15th century had more compassion and more understanding of love than Californians did in 2009 when they went to the polls.
Absolutely. And it's once again this thing. We are here to become fully human, to develop ourselves. And it's once again this liberal attitude of preserving life on the planet, making sure that everything is able to thrive to its best of capabilities. Versus this fundamentalist, it doesn't really matter how long as you live defending your faith. However silly it is, because let's face it, there were infants here who were slaughtered because of Felicity's hard stand, and it's something which is incomprehensible and which is making the opening of the book so powerful. Now, opening of the books, the opening of Christianity. I, for a very long period of time, have been interested, as you know, in the Renaissance, and specifically because of the Corpus Hermeticum, the Hermetic tradition, which really is something which is beginning to take hold of Europe, because what it is the belief that the Hermetica is the philosophy, all the knowledge of ancient Egypt. And the quest to uncover the labyrinths, the quest to conquer Egypt, all has to do with the fact that people want to go to Egypt and uncover the core Egyptian belief from which the Hermetic tradition and the Hermetic beliefs are developed. And the Hermetica very much, in my opinion, officially the Hermetica is written in the centuries post-Christ. But there is wonderful research by a Dutch guy called Bruno Sticker, who is a who got his PhD on identifying the fact that the Corpus Hermeticum was written, most likely by Manetho, on Greek orders in the 3rd century BC. And what was happening at that moment in time was that in Alexandria you had three large components. You had the Greeks, the Egyptians, and the Jews all living together. And the Greek rulers felt that each group of nations, of religions, needed to know aspects, if not the whole body of knowledge of the other traditions, the other religions. And as a result of that, he asked the chief rabbis, he asked the Greek philosopher, and he asked Manetho, who was the high priest of Heliopolis, to codify their religion and make it accessible to the other people living in Alexandria. And as a result, the Corpus Hermeticum was born, which really is a synopsis of that ancient Egyptian literature. And at the same time, what the Ptolemy rulers of ancient Egypt did as well was they created a new deity, Serapis, which was a mixture of the Apis bull and Osiris. And when I started looking into specifically the figure of Marsilio Ficino, the person who was instrumental in helping Cosimo de' Medici in bringing the Renaissance about and gathering all the knowledge and getting it out to both the painters and everybody else, was the fact that Ficino became extremely interested in Serapis, but also in the Apis bull. There are actually references in literature. But what I also found very interesting was that up until about the 3rd century AD, there was this little joke going around in ancient Egypt that really the priests of Serapis were indistinguishable almost from the Christians, specifically that the bishops of original Christianity almost seemed to dress as specifically as the Serapis priests. Now, what is little known but is a completely accepted fact is that the Library of Alexandria was actually the library which was attached to the Serapeum. The Serapeum and the cult of Serapis was a wisdom tradition. People had to acquire wisdom, and as a result of which they had to read books. And what we find in the 15th century with the Medici court is very much the same thing. We have Cosimo spending a gigantic fortune in sending out emissaries, in having contacts across Europe, across the Middle East, into trying to get to him certain manuscripts. And one chief manuscript stands out, which is the Corpus Hermeticum, this hermetic treatise of 14 small tractates. And as soon as he gets his hand on them, he tells Ficino to drop everything else which he's translating and to translate the Corpus Hermeticum into Latin. And he brings about what is known as the Hermetic Revival, and which is seen as some of the big inspirations for the Renaissance. So we have touched upon this Egyptian dimension. We have also seen Egyptian components into the Heros Gamos, the rituals which were practiced. There's a lot of Egypt around, Kathleen.
There is a lot of Egypt. And, you know, I want to say that Marsilio Ficino is such an incredible character. In a lot of ways, Ficino is the character that brought you and I together. Because Absolutely. Before we knew each other well, you know, you knew I was working on this book and I knew you knew a lot about Ficino. So we originally sort of got together so that I could sort of pick your brain about this extraordinary character, Ficino, who is essential to the understanding of the Renaissance and the understanding of the Medici family. Marsilio Ficino is Lorenzo's primary teacher. Lorenzo had a number of teachers, but of course, because of course, if you are going to invest all of this, you know, time and energy into bringing forth a child who you think is the Messiah, you are also going to invest an enormous amount of time and energy into making sure that he has all of the proper training and tutors. And certainly this is what his grandfather did. His grandfather made sure that, that Lorenzo was surrounded by, the best possible teachers. And, Of course, he was trained in the classics. But then Ficino was brought in to give him this sort of supplemental training. And Ficino is such an extraordinary character. He's a doctor. He is a healer. He is an astrologer. He is a scientist in his own right. He is a philosopher. And he is an extraordinary linguist. And at the age of 18, Ficino is capable of translating these ancient texts from the Greek into what is essentially the Latin vernacular at the time. He becomes sort of the great treasure of the Medici family. And certainly Cosimo is, completely devoted to Ficino's education. Because what happens is Ficino is one of these angelic talents that Cosimo essentially adopts. Marsilio Ficino is the son of Cosimo de' Medici's doctor, and he watches Ficino from the time he is very young sort of grow into these gifts, and then Cosimo is responsible for making sure that Ficino gets whatever he needs to fulfill his gifts, and therefore by the time he's 18, he's the most incredible prodigy, you know, in Italy. And this is, as you said, at the time, Cosimo then goes, he spends the equivalent of what would now be millions of dollars sending expeditions around the world to places like Greece, places like Turkey, what we would now call the Near East, in search of documents. He was, I believe he was in search of the Emerald Tablet, or tablets, plural. We know that he was looking for an awful lot of important things. History actually sort of records that that Cosimo was looking for secret manuscripts, hidden manuscripts, hidden knowledge, and bringing all this back with the hopes that, Ficino, who he had trained, would be able to translate and interpret. Also, in the middle of all this, what I want to say is that Cosimo then establishes what is essentially the first public library, what becomes later the Laurentian Library, because Lorenzo then takes it and expands it, and ultimately the Medici family opens it to the public. But Cosimo, again, this is not a man who was hoarding knowledge. This is not a man who wanted this information for his own personal power or for the power of his family. This is a man who wanted the information because he wanted to share it with the world, because he wanted to create a golden age, because he wanted to change the way society looked at life, because he wanted us to see spirituality in the way that he believed we were originally supposed to have it, as this incredible gift, this connection to the divine. He wanted to circumvent, the shackles of the church and present this wisdom and this knowledge to as many people as he could give it to. And this is the true gift of the Medici family. Not just that they cultivated all of this wisdom and art, but that they so desperately wanted to share it with the world.
Absolutely. And it's once again, it's what they're doing is so on par, which was happening in the first centuries AD and BC in Egypt. And there is also, of course, throughout all your books, the reference to that book, the Libro Rosso. And that book becomes very paramount again, because that book really is instrumental into the Medici's power. What you have highlighted as, or written rather, into the appendix of the Book of Love, that the Medici's had the Book of Love, becomes a very important aspect of what the Medici's are able to do in the Renaissance, but also going forward in time.
Well, fans of the Rennes Le Chateau mysteries and the French aspect of these mysteries will understand why I was so excited as I began really getting into this research. What I discovered was that there was a secret meeting that had been recorded by Cosimo de' Medici. And it was a secret meeting between Cosimo de' Medici and René d'Anjou, good King René. Who, as those who are not familiar with these traditions, let me just say that he was an incredibly powerful and important humanist figure in France and in Italy, because he was the king of Naples as well. But he was also more famous, I think, in the common parlance as being Joan of Arc's patron, essentially. He was the man behind Joan of Arc, as was his mother. So the fact that this extraordinarily powerful and important French noble figure comes to Florence to secretly meet with Cosimo really got my attention, and I had to sort of know what that was about. But then I discovered an even sort of bigger monumental piece of information, which is that the date of their meeting is painted in an astronomical configuration in the dome of the Basilica of San Lorenzo. So this has been something that has puzzled historians for hundreds of years. Why did Cosimo have this particular stellar configuration, which represented a specific date in Florentine history, painted into the Basilica of San Lorenzo? And the answer is it represented his meeting with René d'Anjou. But no one until now knows why. And the why is a huge part of the opening of The Poet Prince. So you'll have to read the book to find out, because I'm not going to reveal it here because it's too big of a spoiler. But it is the piece that really joins together the French heretical traditions and the Italian heretical traditions by showing you that René d'Anjou and Cosimo de' Medici were basically brothers in this order, and they came together to do this work. And it is René who brings the Libro Rosso, the book of the heretical teachings, basically home to Italy and to the Medici family. But the other thing that I discovered in this process that was so powerful and so important is that King Louis XI of France, another very, very important and powerful heretical king who not incidentally becomes king and is coronated on July 22nd, which is the feast day of Mary Magdalene, he, in his correspondence to Lorenzo de' Medici, refers to him in several occasions as cousin. Now, this is a huge, huge thing in this period of time, because you have to remember, this is the king. This is the French royal family, the most elite bloodline in Europe. And the Medici are merchant class. The Medici, for all of their wealth and all of their power, come from a class of merchants. They are not nobility. They're certainly not royalty. And yet here is the king of France referring to Lorenzo and Lorenzo's father as his cousin. He speaks to them in these very familiar terms. The same king allows the Medici to then use the fleur-de-lis, which is a French royal emblem solely at this time. He gives the Medici permission to use the fleur-de-lis as part of the Medici emblem. And no one ever asks why. Hold on. No one ever asks why this happens. And I had to know. I absolutely had to know. This is a big deal. The King of France is referring to the Medici as his cousins. The King of France is allowing the French royal symbol to be used by the Medici family. Why? Why did this happen? And that question was one of, you know, the things that really fueled my need to understand the connection between France and Italy during this period of time, how it all came together. And all of that is part of the story that I tell in The Poet Prince.
And you were saying how they left this painting on the dome of a church. In the last week, we spoke and we introduced angels. We introduced gigantic painters, and we also touched upon a person who in name is the Archangel Michael, and who left a gigantic painting on a church, the Sistine Chapel. Michelangelo
is such a critical character, not just because he created the most sublime, beautiful, unbelievable art in the world, but because he arrives with this extraordinary legacy. Now, we talked a little bit about this last week, but just to recap, the idea was this. In the Renaissance, particularly the people surrounding the Medici family, there was an understanding, a belief that children were being born who were angelic, who were coming in with angelic talents and angelic abilities. There was a confraternity called the Confraternity of the Magi, and they were astrologers. They were committed to the same sort of Magi teachings as the same Magi we find, you know, in the Nativity, who predict the coming of Jesus. Okay, same idea. The Magi's responsibility is to determine when the angelic children would be born so that they could begin watching for them. Now, certainly they weren't watching everybody. They were watching specific families and specific bloodlines. Now, the Buonarroti family, which is the family in which Michelangelo is born into, had claimed that they were descendants of the great Matilda of Canossa, the great Countess of Tuscany. And they were ridiculed for that claim because the church and history said that Matilda did not have any living descendants. But the Buonarroti were determined to prove that they were descended from Matilda, and claimed that they could. And this became a major theme in Michelangelo's life later on. Now, if you are not familiar with Matilda of Canossa, then you didn't read the Book of Love, because my second book, The Book of Love, is all about Matilda's legacy. And just to give a little bit of a shout out to Matilda, this is arguably the most interesting woman I've ever come across in history. This is a woman who literally changed the world, and yet very few people have ever heard of her. The first woman to fight for equality, the first leader anywhere in Europe to fight for equality, to say that men and women were equal. But also, in the middle of feudalism, Matilda says the poor and the rich are equal in the eyes of God. And that was a big one. No one had ever said anything like that before. It was really considered very outrageous. So Matilda is out there in the, you know, in the end of the 11th century, really fighting for equality and really trying to change the world and bring more compassion into the politics of Europe. She is an exceptional character. She also controls, you know, about a third of the Italian landmass, and so she's a very powerful character. So certainly people in Italy have heard of her and know of her, but most people outside of Italy do not. And she certainly deserves to be remembered because she truly changes the world. And she is one of the first leaders who functions under this idea of the time returns. She understood it. She was a student of these teachings, and she believed that the time was returning within her reign. So now we cut to 350 years later, and the Buonarroti family is claiming to be descended from her, and therefore part of a very, very specific and elite bloodline in Italy. So what we have is we have this extraordinary child being born to the Buonarroti family, who is being born within the time frame that the Magi are saying is an angelic period. They are saying that this child being born to this bloodline family at this time is going to be blessed with very specific angelic talents. Now, you can all say, oh, you know, maybe, maybe not, or that sounds crazy. But let's think about this for a minute. Prior to his birth, it was an extremely unusual, if not unheard of, thing to name your child specifically Archangel Michael. Because remember, his name isn't Michael. His name is Michelangelo. He is named for the Archangel Michael. From the minute he arrives, he is being watched as a child who was born under a very, very special angelic legacy. Thus, he is named after the Archangel, and he is watched. I mean, they notice by the time he's 6 or 7 exactly how gifted he is. This isn't something that happens by accident. You don't notice that a 6 or 7-year-old is dramatically talented unless you're really, really looking for this. So this child is cultivated. He is watched. He is protected. He is nurtured. And ultimately, he is sent from his homeland in the more southern piece of Tuscany up to Florence to come and become a part of the Medici world. At the age of 13, Lorenzo de' Medici adopts Michelangelo in everything but name. And this is another thing that's such an important piece of history, and yet you very rarely see it discussed, but it's critical. At the age of 13, Michelangelo enters the Medici household. Lorenzo loves him so much that he puts him at his right hand at dinner time. So at meals, Michelangelo is sitting at Lorenzo's right hand with all of the other Medici children. He is raised as a Medici from the time he's 13. And then Lorenzo dies when Michelangelo's about 15 and a half. And I actually believe that that was arguably the most traumatic event in Michelangelo's life, was the loss of Lorenzo.
Absolutely. And it kind of like comes to the end of the poet prince, because after Lorenzo's death, you really see that the Renaissance continued to go on, but once again it seems to transform and somewhat dilute the really big promise which the Renaissance had, the really big transformation of Florence and the big transformation of the world which everybody was hoping for, once again didn't happen. So in to some extent the time returns kind of returned, but once again didn't show or live up to its full potential. Now, we're not going to spoil too much of the final parts of the book, but the Manchi people did get some very powerful people into very powerful positions.
Oh yes, they did. We'll wait for that for a minute, because what I want to talk about is the other aspect of this book that that really, when I started doing the research, you know, it's so funny to me. Sometimes I start researching history, and I'm turning pages, and I think, how come I don't know this? Why don't I know this? Why aren't we taught this? Why doesn't anyone ever talk about this? This is such an important thing in history, and we don't know it. You know, why aren't we taught this information in history? And, you know, without wanting to spoil too much, you know, what happens in Lorenzo's reign is the church comes after him in a huge way. And the Pope himself is part of a plan to murder Lorenzo and his brother. Now, if that's not bad enough, then they don't only plan to murder the Medici brothers. They plan to murder them in the Cathedral of Florence during Easter Sunday Mass, using priests as assassins. And the signal for them to stab the Medici brothers to death is when the host is raised on the altar to signal the beginning of the communion process. Now, for me, reading this over and over again, I'm stunned that nobody talks about it. I mean, this was the essence of the corruption of the church in this piece of early Renaissance Florence. This is exactly what the Medici were trying to combat. And this is why the church was such an incredible mess, and the Medici were so committed to revolutionizing it from the inside out. They took the point of view, because they were very canny politicians and smart statesmen, that if you can't beat them, join them. And ultimately, when they knew that they could not beat the church, they decided they were going to infiltrate it. And we'll sort of get back to that in a second in terms of how that worked, you know, to some extent. But here we have this plot against the Medici brothers that the church has created, and they're going to massacre them in the middle of a cathedral. Now, I don't know about you, but I don't think that fits the idea of what would Jesus do.
Probably not, no.
So, you know, you only have to pick up a history book to find out what happened. So I'm not spoiling too much by telling you that Lorenzo survives. And he is ultimately excommunicated for surviving. That is essentially what happens. The church excommunicates Lorenzo for surviving the massacre, the attempted massacre. But it's an incredibly dramatic point of the book. The story of how this happens, what happens with the conspiracy, who doesn't live and who does die, and how Florence is thrown into absolute turmoil, is for me one of the most interesting pieces of history ever. And I certainly hope that people will read it, because it's mesmerizing. I just could not get past it when I was researching it. It's really an extraordinary period, with incredible characters, some of the most noble and some of the most horrific characters you will ever find anywhere are in this story of what happens to Lorenzo and his brother.
Absolutely. And as you pointed out, the Pazzi conspiracy, as it's called, is one of those things which everybody has heard of, at least the name, but seems to quickly forget about it. And what you bring out in The Purged Prince, you bring it alive, but your emotions, my emotions, went through the roof when you see, like, the total, you know, like, first of all, the total factual basis on which you're relating it, but kind of that makes it even worse. You kind of, you want to go, no, I really want this to be fiction, because this is so outrageous. But then there's always the saying, those who laugh at the end laugh best.
Yes, those who laugh last laugh best. And that is very, very true. And I'm not going to go into the ending, because that's we really find out in the ending how deeply the Medici did affect the church when, after all of this happens. But, you know, there's a lot of irony and a lot of tragedy in the Medici story, certainly. And one of the great ironies is this. this is a family who understood these ancient traditions and this incredible mysticism and power of it. This is a family that revered Mary Magdalene and revered the divine feminine and loved their Madonnas in all kinds of ways. This is a family that believed in sacred union, that believed in Hieros Gamos. This is Piero de' Medici, Lorenzo's father, and Lucrezia Tornabuoni, although it was initially an arranged marriage, was an ultimate love match. I mean, they were an extraordinary couple. Now, here's where it all goes wrong. And I talked last week a little bit about, you know, what Lorenzo's story is giving us that is such a huge gift for the 21st century is this. By studying the Renaissance, specifically what happens in the Medici family, by studying what went right and what went wrong, we have a primer for how we can create this golden age of Lorenzo's vision right here, right now. We understand what worked, we understand what didn't, and why. And here is where I believe it all goes wrong, where the plot is lost. The plot is lost when we lose the importance of love in the story. And here is what I mean. Lorenzo falls in love as a teenager with a woman who is his soulmate. And everyone knows it, and everyone gets that, and yet they are not allowed to marry. Now, they're not allowed to marry for a number of reasons, one of which is that she is in a different class and her family will not allow it, and also because the Medici have a political idea that they want to work through, and it is this. They want to infiltrate the Catholic Church, and in order to do that, they need Lorenzo to marry a daughter of a powerful Roman family who brings strong church influence. If Lorenzo can marry this Roman girl who has the largest number of relatives in the immediate papal circles, then there is hope to bring Medicis into the church. And so this is what happens. And this is where it all goes astray. When Lorenzo, who they conceived to be brought here as a messiah of a golden age, but they didn't take it to the next level, which was allowing him to marry for love and set an example in his reign of living as a man of love in a sacred union and raising children in that same environment of a sacred union. I truly believe if that had been allowed to happen, that the Renaissance would have been even more golden and even more and certainly sustainable. Whereas once Lorenzo dies, a lot of it falls apart. There's everything kind of, you know, goes to hell, and there's a lot of war and there's a lot of destruction. But because Lorenzo is forced to marry someone who is not about love, and he is forced into what is essentially a terrible marriage, to a woman who does not understand anything about Florence, is a committed Catholic and thinks that everything Lorenzo is doing is heretical and that he's going to go to hell. And as a result, his marriage, from the minute his Roman wife arrives, is difficult, is disruptive, is sad, and produces children who then become instruments of war. And they are instruments of war because their mother wants to educate them in the specific traditional dogmatic ways of the church. And Lorenzo wants to educate them in his progressive humanist spiritual mysticism. And this is where, you know, Lorenzo spends the rest of his life with Clarice, his wife, at war over their traditions and over the children. And as a result, I think that, you know, what could have been an extraordinary legacy that lasted forever becomes something very, very different and ends in a number of cases in tragedy. So this is my point. What the lesson that we need to take from the Medici is that they knew so much. They had so much information about mysticism and practice. And yet when it came to putting everything into play, they ultimately lost that the important factor is the power of love.
To thy own self be true.
Yeah.
And as such, we are at the end of another episode of The Spirit Revolution. We have been discussing this week and last week Kathleen's new book, The Poet Prince, the third in the series of The Magdalene. We are on the web, we are at www.thespiritrevolution.com, where we also archive our shows, so you can go there. You can also go to iTunes and search on The Spirit Revolution. You will find a full archive of our shows there as well. You can also go to the BBS Radio Archives, where you will find us as well. You cannot get away from us. So,
until next time, I just want to close with a few lines of the prayer, which is the prayer of the Order of the Holy Sepulchre, which I open the Poet Prince with. And that prayer is this: we honor God while praying for a time when these teachings will be welcomed in peace by all people, and there will be no more martyrs. Until next week, the truth against the world.